I grew up in like the 70s. We were just this little enclave in Orange County. It was very simple lifestyle, lower middle class. And a lot of people didn't graduate from high school. It wasn't a given, kind of like it is now. So the expectations for me, a girl growing up in the 1970s, they were really low.
Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Cindy Healy. She lives in Woodinville now, but as a teenager in Southern California, she wasn't thinking much about her career.
They just expected me to kind of do what they did and meet somebody in high school and get married. The career advice I got was, you better get in that kitchen and learn how to cook because you're going to be somebody's wife someday. And even though I was a really good student and very self-motivated, my parents just didn't know how to cultivate that. So I graduated from high school with absolutely no plans on what I was going to do next. And then I did what a lot of other Southern California kids do, is I got a job at one of the local amusement parks. And I didn't really think I was Disneyland material, so I opted for a job at Knott's Berry Farm, which actually was really close to my house too. So Knott's Berry Farm, I got a job at the Buffalo Nickel Arcade in the Roaring Twenties, and this was when video games were just coming out. So we had all these new games like Pac-Man and Space Invaders and Galaga. The arcade had that, and then it was just this huge space where they had games of chance where you could land a quarter on a plate and win a huge stuffed animals or get a ring around a bottle, all these things. But the real game changer came one day when I was sitting in the change booth at the arcade. And that was the primo shift to pull down, because you got to sit down all day, got to make announcements over the loudspeaker. And it was kind of like a queen bee type of situation. So I got to sit in there. And one day, my lead, Helen, she was a few years older than me, and she was a student at UC Irvine. And I didn't know much about her. She was pretty quiet. But she came over, and she was seeing if I needed any more change. How was I doing? And then she says, "Do you know why you get to sit in the change booth all the time?" And I said, "No, why?" And she said, "Because your change count is always accurate." And I was like, "Well, how hard is that?" And she said, "Oh, you'd be surprised." And so I'm thinking, the Rolodex in my head is spinning through like all my other peers. And it's like, how can they not make change accurately? Or are they stealing or whatever? It's like, how could this be so hard? To me, it just seemed so basic. And she asked me, she goes, "Are you good at math?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm good at math. I'm not like in the mathlete club or anything, but I'm good at math. I'm not one of those people who's afraid of math." And she said, "If you're good at math, you should enroll in a university and you should major in computer science. It's a growing field. They need women, and starting salaries are $25,000. And I was like, "Whoa, $25,000. Yeah, head explodes, because I was making $2.20 an hour at Knott's, for reference, right? And I had already been across the street to these apartments that some of my coworkers were basically flopping in together. Like, they were scraping together four people with minimum wage jobs. They had just enough money to pay the rent, to kind of stay stocked in beer and pizza and walk across the street to work. None of them had cars or insurance or any of that. And I had been to their apartment for a party and thought, I don't want to live like this. This is what $2.20 an hour gets you." And so $25,000 sounded like the right idea. I really didn't know what computer science was or what computer programming was. I really hadn't touched a computer up until that point. But I just thought, I'm going to try it. I'm going to go for it. Why not? And so I figured out how to enroll at San Diego State University, and I checked that box that said computer science, even though I didn't know exactly what I was getting myself into, and I went for it.
Cindy Healy would go on to graduate with a computer science degree, just like Helen, her theme park supervisor, told her to. She quickly found work in the aerospace industry, and not just any old work.
That first job, I worked on the backup flight system for the space shuttle. This was the return to flight after the Challenger disaster. So I went and worked on submarines, and then I worked on a top secret missile thing where I, you know, had to get a severe background check and everything. I got put on the Mars Pathfinder project, and that was just like one of the big highlights of my whole career.
Cindy later moved into the technology sector, and now she's a manager at Microsoft. And that chat in the change booth at Knott's Berry Farm is still on her mind.
I go to such a place of gratitude that Helen didn't have to take time out of her day to recognize my mad change counting skills or to even acknowledge anything about me. And she took the time to pay me a compliment and to catch me being good at something. And so I really try to do that with people.
Well, how lucky are you that Helen saw your mad change counting skills and didn't say, hey, you'd be a great checker at Safeway? She said, you'd be a great computer scientist.
I know. It's so random. I was just sitting there with no direction, and one conversation would change my entire life. And so I'm forever grateful. And I think you never know who's listening. You never know who one word of kindness or one word of encouragement or even some great advice, that it could change somebody's life forever. And it all stems from that one conversation.
This week on Sound Effect, our theme is hidden talents, stories about people with skills that go unnoticed or unremarked upon, except, Cindy Healy says, to the people who are really paying attention.
Gosh, when I think about identifying hidden talents in people, part of it is your mindset. You know, I know for me what I've done is I've said, hey, I'm going to see how many people I can catch being great at something today. It's just like one of those things. If you said, hey, I'm going to see how many pennies I can find on the sidewalk, you'd find pennies because you're thinking about it. If I say, hey, I'm going to catch people being great at things today or being good at things today, and then I'm going to take time to make sure that I give them that reinforcing feedback, I'll find the opportunities, but I have to be intentional about it.
Cindy Healy directs employee learning experiences at Microsoft. She lives in Woodinville. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is hidden talents. Bent Washburn grew up in a little town in Utah in a devout Mormon household. He says the end times were a regular topic of family conversation.
We would talk about the prophecies all the time, you know, the typical Christian prophecies that all Christian churches have, like moon turns to blood and then wars and rumors of wars, just all these from the Revelation. Mormons also have one particular prophecy where we would return to Missouri. I don't know if you know the history. Mormons were kicked out of Missouri and we were forced to Utah. But what was going to happen is right before Jesus came, all of society falls apart. The stores close down. There's no buses or trains. And then Mormons would walk, quote, the rusty rails back to Missouri, would set up camp there, and then Jesus would come. And so I believed all this.
Bent had other dreams, too, ones that had little to do with religion. But before those ambitions could emerge, circumstances would test his faith in the two things he trusted most, his church and his mom. When Bent was a kid, preparing for the end of days was as normal as planning for a family vacation.
For the impending apocalypse that was coming, we were commanded to have a year's supply of food, which we went above and beyond. It was easy. My mom was way into that. In fact, she got so into it. This is before Costco. She started selling luxury apocalyptic supplies all over the western United States. I remember coming home. She's on the phone selling 25-pound boxes of chocolate chips. And the sales pitch was like, you know, during that apocalypse, you know, that time when things are tough, wouldn't it be nice to be able to feed your husband and your kids chocolate chip cookies? All this was rational to me. It was believable. It made sense. And it was comforting. It was a comforting story. It's a shelter, really, the story of the religion, you know, in a big universe and world. It's comforting if you believe it. But then two things happen. First, puberty. You know, it's easy to make a vow of chastity when you're 9, and sex is the grossest thing. So the shelter starts to feel a little confining, a little more like a prison at that point. And then I fell in love with comedy and art. I started pursuing those. Just, I loved them as a kid. I loved telling jokes. I loved the attention that I got when I made people laugh. My parents had a really good sense of humor. And they were funny people. Steve Martin, you remember when he had the big, he exploded onto the television. He was everywhere. My parents loved him. He was amazing. And they got two of his albums, Let's Get Small, Wild and Crazy Guy. And they didn't listen to him. They didn't listen to him. They just assumed he was a clean comedian because that's the way he was on TV. And I was too young to know that these were dirty jokes. I didn't know. I just drugged Dad in like a week later. Come listen, Dad. And I remember the exact line. Steve Martin, I can't remember which album, where he sings out, he sings, Grandpa bought a rubber. And my dad just said, what is that? And he's like, Lori has kept started playing. He says, Lori, these aren't clean. This is, and he took, you know, just ripped the albums off. And we never saw him again. He chucked them. There's one comic they always trusted, Bill Cosby. I'm not kidding. That was the comic everybody, well, he was clean. It's amazing to me. So I figured I couldn't do comedy. It wasn't compatible with going to heaven as a Mormon. You couldn't stay in the shelter. So I pursued fine art, and I started doing everything you're supposed to do to have a successful life path as a Mormon. I went on my mission when I turned 19, the suit, the bike, they sent me to Seattle here, and that's when I first came to Seattle for 2 years. I was a Spanish-speaking missionary. I walked all through the streets of downtown Seattle, up into some scary hotels. Had a gun pulled on me once. That happened. But I did that for 2 years. I came home. I did what you're supposed to do. I got married immediately because I wanted to have sex. That's how delusional I was. I got married so I could have lots of sex, which is crazy. But I just was doing it even though my doubts were starting to grow. I think fine art is what opened my eyes to my own doubt. When you do a painting, you can do anything, right? There's like, paint what you want, which becomes, well, what do I want to paint? Which turns into the question, what do I want? Which turns into the question, who am I? It just opens up all sorts of doors that you should probably leave closed, you know, if you want to stay on that pathway. And I was not succeeding in the art. My marriage was not good, and I was miserable. I continually still did comedy, like all during pursuing my art. I still did that on the side. It's the thing I loved to do. I'd go to open mics down in the city of Salt Lake City. That was where the scene was, if you could call it that, and do comedy. But it was on the side. It was something I knew I couldn't do and go to heaven. And I was trapped. I was miserable. I didn't have enough faith for that church or the religion to deliver the comfort anymore. I didn't believe enough to feel comforted by it. But I did have enough faith to feel guilty. My faith is weakening, and I'm in this place of doubt. My mom, the person, kind of the linchpin of my belief or opinions, the bedrock of it, where it all started, became more and more believing. She started to double down on the religion. She started to really get more and more strict. And then one day, out of the blue, she called. And she said, Bent, I bought you some shoes. These are very nice shoes. You're going to need them because hard times are coming. She started to talk in this prophecy-laden just... she was referencing the walk back to Missouri. You're going to need these shoes. It's the end times. And sounded really panicky. And I thought, this is strange. This is even for her above and beyond. So I called my brothers. What's going on? They said, oh, you haven't heard? Yeah. Mom saw Jesus appeared to her in her closet and gave her basically a blueprint and told her, you need to gather your family and leave civilization and go out to is a place called Mona, Utah, which is kind of middle of nowhere, and build a compound. She had this vision. And so now I have these shoes. And I tumble that around for a while. I think about it. I said, I better go in. I wanted to see how she was doing. I stepped into the house, and that's when I think when I first started to really see what was going on. Yeah, I mean, there's stuff's piled everywhere. And they go into the basement, and they have these ridiculous amounts of apocalyptic supplies built up. Just tons. They have lumber everywhere and weird stuff, like toys. So kids would have toys. She bought me a bunch of canvas so I could paint during the apocalypse. There was all just herbal teas, just pallets full. And she had just been emptying the bank account on this stuff. And then up in the kitchen, on the table, there was this lump of, it looked to me like it was lead. And I picked it up and I said, Mom, what's this? She said, well, Scott was a brother-in-law, the Lord has led Scott to a silver mine. This is a crazy part. Scott was about 350 pounds, and apparently God, he had gotten on his mountain bike, and God had led him about 10 miles out to some vacant fields by Utah Lake where silver, she said, silver was just coming up out of the ground. And I thought, oh, that sounds absolutely insane, you know? And by the way, to add to this, my dad wasn't just a doctor, he was a psychiatrist. So, yeah, this is where it gets. That should have been a detail earlier, but maybe it's more interesting that you know now that he is a psychiatrist and his wife is starting to do these things. And I said, well, what does Dad think about the silver mine, Mom? And she said, well, your dad thinks it's lead. So what did you tell Dad, Mom? And she said, well, I told your father, well, Phil, why would God lead Scott to a lead mine? And that's when I just thought, well, wait a second. This isn't religion. This is crazy. And then all of that bedrock, all the opinions, everything that I had, you know, believed that she had said, it was like she was so much of the basis of that faith, became so questionable. So questionable. It's like, I remember leaving and feeling it was strange. I felt a little sad that she was mentally ill, obviously, but I felt this relief being released from that faith, you know, that toxic amount. It was her loss of her sanity that did that for me. At that moment, it's like that faith went away. And as I look back, what I find amazing is really Jesus did come back to my mom's closet and in a way saved me. It saved me because it released me. I mean, from that day forward, I could have a cup of coffee with no guilt, none at all. And I started just doing the comedy. I would swear on stage in public and just like, no, I don't think it's wrong. And I'm not going to worry about this. Yeah, that was the beginning, I think. I mean, and from then on, I started doing comedy shortly thereafter. I just, all over the country, living in my car, the tent, in the trunk. I lived outside of Seattle for about a month in my tent, in the rain, and just giddy. Because for the first time in my life, it was mine. It did not belong to the church. It belonged to me.
That's comedian Bent Washburn. He says his mom largely recovered from her breakdown. Both of his parents have since died. He says before that, they did come to see a couple of Bent's performances, and he says they were proud of what he did. When Bent isn't doing comedy, he hosts the Rule of Three podcast, which he calls 30 Minutes of Nothing You Need to Hear. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is hidden talents. At first glance, hidden is not the word you'd use for Chance McKinney's talents. As an athlete in high school and college, he got plenty of recognition.
I got a track scholarship to Third Jav and went to a Pac-12 school. And I mean, I kept qualifying for the Olympic trials.
But this very capable guy has a whole other set of gifts that weren't so obvious. They emerged years later when he was teaching high school math in Mukilteo. On a whim, he had submitted an original song to a music contest. And then somehow, to his shock, McKinney's country song blew up.
I'm sitting there in a math class with ABC television and radio stations and newspapers and everybody and my kids, you know, from that class, finding out that I had a number one on CMT. I had no band, no nothing. It was just, here I am, Chance McKinney, number one unsigned singer-songwriter. I'll always, always
be real. Chance is now a successful, full-time country musician. But his motivation to achieve, both in sports and in music, comes largely from being bullied as a child.
You know, it's strange to sit in the same room with me. You would think that I never got bullied. I'm a little bigger than everybody else and always have been. But, you know, my dad told me that the only time you ever fight is when you get backed into a corner. And he said, if you do, then I'll handle it when you get home. So I'd just kind of grown up being a jovial, big kid, and a couple kids moved into school and in middle school, and looking back at it now, I kind of understand why they bullied me, because they grew up in not such good households. I didn't understand at the time, for sure, but I was loved at home, and I don't know how much they were. And that, you know, when you got a big target like I was, every kid wants to establish their dominance on the playground. And so, you know, when you got a problem with two or three kids and they're always coming after you, it kind of got to be the thing there for about 2 or 3 years. I mean, it messed with my self-esteem. I mean, I went home and I cried on the couch downstairs every day. My folks would walk in and be like, what happened today? And, you know, some days I'd tell them, some days I wouldn't. And it just felt like constant mosquitoes, constant verbal torture. I never fought back. And I don't know why, but then my dad would turn that around and we'd be heading to a baseball game, or we'd be heading, yeah, I pitched all through, you know, middle school, and, you know, we'd be on our way to a game and he's like, you still worrying about school today? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, go ahead and take that out on the players you're going up against. And, I mean, I had games where I'd strike out the entire team, you know. We'd go, you know, a six-inning game or a seven-inning game, and I'd end up with 20 strikeouts. There was a method to his madness. I still got bullied a little bit in high school. It was always, you know, people kind of found out I was an easier target or wouldn't fight back. But I do remember, I do remember being on, you know, teams where those kids who were picking on me in social life could not make the team. And I would tell my dad, oh, so-and-so, you know, pushed me around the halls today, but he got cut from the basketball team. And he's like, how's that make you feel? And I said, pretty damn good. And he goes, me too. And I took that approach, you know, to unleash the pent-up frustration that I had in athletics. Life was athletics, man. I mean, it was one sport to the next. And this kind of, as my athletic career started to wind up, I needed an outlet. And I got turned on to music, and that's my new sport. So I record a really terrible first CD, get an appointment with Becky Brenner. Becky was the senior most woman in CBS radio for, I don't know, 40 years. So I get an appointment with KMPS, which happened to be the seventh largest country station in the nation at the time. And I have no representation, no nothing. I'm just 2 years out of college and here we go. I've got a CD. I'm going to get this on the radio. So I walk in. She takes the meeting with me. I have no idea why. And she sits across the desk and she throws it in. She's listening maybe 13 seconds of each song, maybe 22 at the best. She takes it out, puts it back in the case, throws it across the desk and goes, this is really bad. And I went, well, it's 9 of my first 13 songs. And she goes, dear God, never play that for anyone. And I went, I'll get better. And she goes, I hope so. And so she continued to so eloquently berate me right there. And I just kind of sat there and took it. And I said, I'll get better. And it wasn't 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks later, she called me and asked me to open for Kenny Chesney. That was my very first country concert.
Say hello, fake a smile, how you been a while. Stop reading my mind, girl. Just like
you know, she opened up a lot of doors for me. I think my fourth show, I was opening Main Stage for Shadazy. We did shows with Kenny Chesney, Rascal Flatts, Toby Keith, Brooks and Dunn, Jason Aldean. That was the new sport. You know, this was my outlet. This was something for me to compete at. And so I started flying down to Nashville and writing with, you know, exceptional writers and learning the craft and, you know, taking singing lessons and learning to play guitar. It was like it all happened so fast when those opportunities came.
Said some things we don't mean, second thoughts in between. Now and then got us right here.
You got to understand that, you know, I think my biggest year was I did 120 some shows, and then I took 104 flights that year. But I've always told people that 90% of the shows you're up for are no's. I don't know if I took offense to any of that, but definitely my past, dealing with, you know, middle schoolers and being an athlete played a part in. I don't know if I did part of it to spite people, or if I just to prove them wrong, or to prove myself that I could do it. I still to this day, I don't see myself in the mirror as anything but a 6th, 7th, or 8th grader. That time period is entrenched in my life. I still get no's, and I still have plenty of doubters. And I'm just trying to make them wrong and all the people who do believe in me right.
Are you a... Three little words on the screen, but it's so much more when I read in between all the lines.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Kevin Kinista.
How many times will I let you in, let you mess with my mind? It's like you've got a sixth sense, you always seem to know when I'm home all alone, I should tell you I won't.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week on Sound Effect, we're telling stories of hidden talents. It was political violence that drove Al Sada to leave his home country. He fled El Salvador's civil war and found his way to Seattle. He made a life for himself here, started a business, and did his best to forget about politics. But recently, Al discovered talents he didn't even know he had, and he was able to use them to help shape the future of El Salvador. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman brings us the story.
People were killed for the smallest reasons during El Salvador's civil war, like listening to anti-government lyrics, or just talking to someone who was against the military. The whole conflict had to do with widespread inequality, and it pitted the U.S.-backed government against rebel forces for more than a decade. Tens of thousands died, an unknown number went missing. Al Sade was in middle school at the time.
The soldiers came into my classroom, and they kicked the door, and the first thing what they did, they shoot my teacher. And then I saw him getting unbalanced and just fall down, and the kids, they were screaming. I just covered myself with my chairs and the tables, and I just stayed on the ground. And some girls and other boys, girls and boys, they were got shooting. So there were, I believe, 12 kids out of my classroom killed that day.
Al was lucky to be alive. The memory haunted him long after he fled El Salvador to come to the U.S.
I did not like the fire works, because it reminds me being the fired arms in El Salvador.
The other thing Al stayed away from, politics, specifically in El Salvador. The Civil War left a bad taste in his mouth that never really got scrubbed out. Corruption persisted. Gang violence is so rampant that it makes the news when a day goes by without a killing. All this to say that Al stopped paying attention to politicians who promised change that never came.
But this time, it was totally different.
Much is at stake in this presidential election in this Central American nation.
Bukele, con tan solo 37 años, el exalcalde de San Salvador.
Nayib Bukele en la creación de un nuevo partido político llamado Nueva Nación.
Nayib Bukele, a 37-year-old businessman and former mayor of this capital city.
Here was a guy who promised to fix El Salvador, Nayib Bukele.
If you have 100% poor, urban, young people joining the gangs, that's a social problem, 100% social problem.
Bukele is young, he's progressive, and he talked about restoring the country to prosperity in a way that didn't feel hollow to Al. After all, Bukele pushed major social reforms when he was mayor of San Salvador, the country's largest city. Why couldn't he do the same thing as its president?
With this, it kind of opened a big window to me and kind of encouraged me, hey, there's something here that you can help out.
Here's the thing. Al isn't some political operative. He owns a janitorial company. And while he's done some advocacy work in the past, it was never on the scale of a presidential election. But there was one thing he could do. Vote. It's not the most straightforward process, but basically, expats from El Salvador can still cast a ballot in the country's elections. Al just had to figure out how to help other people do the same. So he did what a lot of Salvadorans do in Seattle when they need help. He reached out to Anna Castro, or as Al calls her, Anita.
He said, Anita, I wanted to talk to you about something. And I told him, okay, go ahead, let's meet at the bakery.
Anna is sort of an icon in the local Salvadoran community. A lot of that has to do with the bakery she started with her sister. It was the 90s, shortly after they fled their home country.
If you put Salvadorian bakery in Seattle, the first that will come is the Salvadorian bakery.
So it'd be like if I went to El Salvador and I Googled El Salvadoran bakery, like a million things would come up. But right. When you come to Seattle, only right. Yours comes
right.
Up.
Right, exactly. Yeah. In fact, that's how we end up becoming like a institution more than a business.
Anna says all sorts of people come to her store, from newly arrived immigrants to politicians as far as Congress. Al figured it'd be a good place to launch a grassroots movement. So he and Anna met along with a small group of supporters, and things just snowballed from there. They made a Facebook group, they did some fundraising. One day, Al went to a local library to help register voters. A huge crowd showed up for only a handful of slots.
I had a lady literally crying. I want to really be able to vote. Can you enroll me?
Al couldn't. He only had enough materials for 7 people. He was by himself. There was a line out the door. This frantic excitement ended up taking hold over the whole building.
I could describe to you like this, like a rifle.
Like a raffle or a lottery, everything was up to chance.
It's sort of like at that time when you and a rifle and then you have a ticket and waiting for to be called out your name. That's the people that were so excited. We want to win. We want to win.
So Al tapped into this energy being felt across the Salvadoran community. People wanted their home country to rise out of this thick mess of corruption and violence. They wanted change. And the guy promising to do that, he started to take notice.
Un saludo a todos los amigos de Nueva Ciudad de Seattle. Desde aquí, desde Madrid.
This is a voicemail on Al's phone, and the person talking is Nayib Bukele. It's a generic message, the type you'd expect from a busy presidential candidate touching base with supporters. Bukele says some kind words about Seattle, but then he goes on to list all these other places.
Suiza, in Alemania, in Italia, in Inglaterra, in Moscow, in Isla Fiji, in Australia, in Sudamérica, y también allá en Seattle, donde están todos ustedes reunidos hoy. También en Estados Unidos, en otro...
So it wasn't just Al. There was a global network of expats rooting for Bukele. And the same thing was happening back in El Salvador.
Contra todo muro. Nadie se interpondrá entre Dios y su pueblo para poder cambiar.
Kelly didn't just win. He took the presidency by a landslide. It was a dazzling defeat of the country's long-standing political forces, a promise of new hope. But the whole thing sparked another question. Would the results have been the same without support from people like Al? One expert in Latin American studies told me Bukele won by such a large margin that there really wasn't any question about where the votes came from. I took the question to Al, and his answer actually made a lot of sense.
Do you actually think that groups like yours made a difference?
It make a difference, but not a huge difference. What it really, really make the big difference is because we're talking about over 2 million people in El Salvador. Every one of us have friends down there. Every one of us have members of family.
People who normally voted along party lines were nudged by friends and family to try something else. It's hard to tell if this actually made a difference, but what we know for sure is that Bukele's victory has created a new sense of hope.
Did any part of helping in this campaign to elect Bukele, did that help in any way the trauma that you experienced?
It have. It's sort of like a cure because the country that I was born, one of the things that I dream of is seeing El Salvador peaceful country and place that maybe when I be older, I could be retired there to go back to a country that would have to be worried about any crimes and being secure.
It's hard to imagine one politician can change the course of an entire country. Bureaucracy is slow. It doesn't work on pride alone. Al gets this. He knows the roadblocks standing in the way of Bukele's vision. But like a lot of people in El Salvador, he's still holding out for change. And at least for the moment, crime is down.
That story from sound effect contributor Max Wasserman. One correction, an earlier version of this story misstated Al Saudez's last name. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect. Our last tale of hidden talents is about a kid who discovers he has a flair for the stage and how one performance would change the summer and maybe even the lives of a bunch of Boy Scouts. That kid was not Wolf Maycutt, but Wolf was profoundly affected by the events in this story. He told it live on stage at a Sound Effect storytelling event last summer.
When I was 8 years old, I wasn't very popular. You know, no surprise. I was a little chubby, and as a typical eight-year-old, I didn't think much about it. I thought maybe it would change someday, and I just didn't worry about it. So I watched a lot of Star Trek and read comic books. My parents had other ideas, and they enrolled me in Cub Scouts. Now, Cub Scouts aren't for everyone, but they were great for me. And that's because my mom was the den mother, and we had cookies, and we had drinks, and we sang songs. And for those of us who were a little competitive, we earned lots of merit badges. And my dad made all of the Pinewood Derby cars for me. So it was a great time. When I turned 11, then I decided to become a scout because why not? This is awesome. I'm really good at this. And my parents thought it would be fantastic too because this would be a chance for me to get in with the good kids. Right? Scouts, right? What could be better than scouts? We would all be very disappointed. We joined Troop 120. And I'm convinced to this day that it was a dumping ground for unwanted children. You could kind of tell because the cars would come along and then they would slow down, sometimes not even stop all the way. The kid would be ejected and they would take off. Like, yes, 2 hours of freedom. Yeah, so these were not the best kids. If you've read Lord of the Flies, that was like a Disney summer camp compared to this. It was intense. I mean, I did make a friend. I made one friend. He was the other reject. His name was, fittingly enough, Jimmy Smallwell. He was actually the smallest kid in the troop, so there was the chubby kid and the small kid, and we just tried to stay out of everyone's way. All the young Cro-Magnons, we just tried to hide. And it's not like there wasn't anyone keeping control of this. There was Mr. J, our scoutmaster. He was, you know, in his early 50s, big brown beard shot through with gray, his breath smelling a little bit acrid, something I would later correspond with whiskey. And he would do an okay job of keeping things under control in the meetings, but as soon as we got out in the woods, there was no keeping any control of these roughnecks. But that's why he had his assistant scoutmaster. They were barely older than some of the scouts themselves. And you know how sometimes you've got people who have just a little bit of power and they really like it a lot? Well, their whole job was to keep us under control and with little punishments. And they were, you know, less the kumbaya and more the spare the rod, spoil the scout. So they had this amazing variety of punishments they would mete out for the smallest thing. May cut. No sock garters, 50 push-ups. Now. Sometimes you're walking along the parade grounds and you think, oh, have I come across some sort of CrossFit getaway or something? No. It's kids doing what they're forced to do. And the worse you got, the worse the punishments got, and the more creative. You know, if you forgot to salute your scoutmaster, you're doing dishes. If you're late for breakfast, you must need to wake up, so you dunk your head in a bucket of ice cold water. So, you know, stuff like that. But for the really, really bad act, they kept a special punishment in store. I remember this one time, Jimmy, he was working on his physics merit badge, and he read how heat affects pressure. So he thought he'd do a scientific experiment, you know, reasonably enough. And so he was about to do this experiment. He had his can of bug spray, and he was moving towards the fire. And suddenly from behind him came this call. Small well, teapot, breakfast. And he just, like, his eyes went wide, and he dropped the can on the ground. And then as the enormity of what had just happened rolled over him, he just collapsed in on himself and wandered off into the woods. He would have the rest of the day and most of the night to dread his upcoming performance. Now, if you want to understand why this is so bad, you have to think back to your preteen self. Like, if you ask your youngsters what scares them most, it's not death, it's not taxes, those are adult things. It's public embarrassment. And this was doubly true in our troop, because there are just bands of bullies going around trying to pick anybody up. And the best way not to get bullied is not to get seen. So here was Jimmy the next day. Imagine it's morning, the birds are chirping, it's a beautiful day, 50 scouts are out in parade rest in the grass, the sun glinting off the dew. Up in front of everybody, there's a 3-foot stage made out of wood, and the scoutmasters are talking about what they're gonna do over the day. Finally, just as attentions are starting to wander, they all come off and they summon Jimmy up onto the stage. Jimmy, looking smaller than ever, comes up, looks around as if Robin Hood might come out of somewhere and save him, but finally starts. I'm a little teapot.
Louder!
I'm a little teapot.
Do the dance!
I'm a little teapot, short and stout. And the kids would inevitably mumble their way through the song, because that's what we've been doing. That's how we're avoiding attention. The less we do, the less they have to pick out. Here is my handle, and here is my spout. And they would do as little as possible in the dance, too, as if this is somehow less attention-giving when 50 sets of eyes are right on you. And the tittering would begin in the back, and then it would move through, and then there would be laughter. And then, I remember poor Jimmy, he would get more and more flushed and scared, and then where was I in the song? It was really important, something about getting steamed up. And then there would be more laughter because he was confused, and it would just be in this vicious circle, like going round and round and round, and finally he just left the stage in tears, which is what would always happen on this punishment. And it was the worst thing they could come up with. This is what I desperately wanted to avoid as the large child, and it was the absolute worst thing that anyone ever saw. And it worked brilliantly until Dave Taffy. Now, Taffy was one of the older scouters, and he was a jerk, just not to put too fine a point on it. He was one of the heads of the bullies, and nobody liked him, and we just wanted him to go, and eventually he would disappear. We suspected it had something to do with the law, but we had no proof. But before then, there was this one time when he was shaking a younger scouter upside down, trying to see what would come out. And the scoutmaster came up behind him. Taffy, teapot, breakfast. He just looked over, threw him a salute, and sauntered off. And we thought, he just put on a brave face. Until the next morning. Next morning, he comes up. The leadership hasn't even gotten off the stage yet, and he bounds up happily. He takes his scout cap, and he throws it into the crowd. He takes his long, dirty hair and brings it down in front of his hair. And then, affecting his best Axl Rose, goes, I'm a little teapot. I am short and stout. Here is my handle, and here is my spout. When I get all steamed up, you can hear me shout. So tip me over and pour me. There was this long, awkward silence. And then one kid in the back started clapping, and then somebody else started clapping, and then suddenly we were all clapping and cheering. And it was amazing to me, even at the time, because I didn't like Taffy. I thought he was terrible. But what he had done, it seemed so utterly heroic to us. He had taken these punishments from these adults who had all this power over us and had used it indiscriminately over and over again to such effect. He had taken the worst they had, and he had owned it, and he had enjoyed it. Mr. J was no fool. That was the end of the teapot punishment. Taffy had broken it forever. My parents enrolled me in scouting to put me in with the good kids and to teach me something about the world. In their second goal, at least, I think they succeeded. Because there's few things from my childhood I really remember better than Taffy's example. That when you're given something, just go for it. It's so much better. And even more important is that sometimes even a stout little teapot can have their day.
Wolf Maycutt works in tech in Seattle. He told that tale at Sound Effects' live storytelling event. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Max Wasserman, Paul Currington, and Kari Plogue. Our executive producer is Floriangela Davila. You can listen on your own schedule when you subscribe to our podcast. It's free and available on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. Leave us a quick rating and review if you like what you hear, and you can also send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX,